You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
I'm back.
And yeah. Evan Bernstein.
Jay's back.
What about his back?
I feel like I haven't done a podcast in a month.
I don't think you have.
Yeah, hasn't it been? Happy February.
So, thanks. How was Sweden?
Sweden was very good. I was away for 2 weeks, and it was a very long time to be away from my family and my two children. My wife and I were FaceTiming every night. And towards the end, it just made it worse. I just felt bad whenever we talked because I just needed to get home to see them. But the trip was great, and I had a great, great experience with the local skeptics. I didn't really get a chance to tell you guys much about this. I happened to be friends with a skeptic in Malmo, Sweden, named Lennart Forsberg.
Malmo?
Malmo.
Now, it's funny. No, I have to think about when...
Julia?
Yeah. One of my daughters was young. Elmo was very popular, and they would call him Malmo.
Aww. I think it was Julia.
Was it Julia? Melmo.
That's what I recall.
Was this before he was a pedophile?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Elmo's a pedophile?
Well, the actor got...
The original voice actor was
Kevin Clash.
Yeah. Wasn't he? Oh, God.
Yeah. You mean the Subway spokesperson, Jared?
No.
Oh, him too.
Well...
No. The Frugal Gourmet.
Jeffrey Jones. Or no, not Jeff Jones, although he had his instance.
Oh, my God, you guys, so many pedophiles.
The Frugal Gourmet?
Yeah, Jeff Smith.
Was it Jeff Smith? Yeah, Frugal
Jeff
Gourmet.
Smith.
I loved his recipes.
Wait, weren't we talking about Sweden?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Not sure.
We got up on a pedophile
tangent.
I honestly, guys, I cannot name names right now after this pedophile list. Like, I'm serious. Let me get back to telling you about my friend whose name is in a list of pedophiles.
Oh, jeez.
All right, we'll give you a clean break. Go. Yes. Tell us about Malmö, Sweden.
Right. Well, first, it's pronounced Malmo.
Okay.
Oh, good.
All right. So I have a friend, Lennart Forsberg, who we met at a hotel that he works at. I stayed in the hotel. He was a listener of the show. He and I became friends. So I had been, I used to go quite often. I went back this year, and he was asking me if I'd like to meet some local skeptics. And I was saying, yes, I have nothing to do. I'm going to have a whole weekend to myself. And it turned out that I ended up giving a talk at an event that Lennart and Pontus Bachmann put together with, they have, a governing body of skeptics there. I met, I think there was like 30 plus people that ended up showing up. Pontus interviewed me for his podcast, which is the European Skeptics Podcast. And that is at theesp.eu, where you can go to right now and hear the full interview/talk that we had. We had a great time. The local group was fantastic. The beer was fantastic.
Mm.
Just had a lot of fun. So I feel like I was very fortunate to be able to spend some time with these people. And, it just turns out that skeptics are very similar. Everywhere we go, the skeptics seem to be very similar. And we have a lot of things in common. So I'd like to, just thank everyone that ended up showing up that night. I had a wonderful time. And I'm looking forward to coming back and seeing you guys again.
Yeah. Well, not much has been happening here while you were gone, to be honest with you.
No. It's been quiet.
Slow. Yeah,
typical week. Typical
week. Yeah, so what was the big thing that happened?
I got a haircut. Oh. I got a real cool haircut.
I got a shave.
So, Bob, tell us about this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science.
So, for this week's Superhero of Science, I'm going to talk about Dr. Lorna Wing, 1928 to 2014. She was a British psychiatrist and physician, and she is also generally considered to be instrumental in changing how we think about autism. Perhaps even more than autism, she is known for reintroducing to the world the work of Dr. Hans Asperger. Maybe sounds familiar. He recognized what he called autistic psychopathy as essentially the most minimal form of autism. And this very important finding, though, was ignored by scientists, partly because it was published during World War II, and nobody really even knew about it for decades. Wing discovered it decades later. It wasn't even translated into English, so she had it translated, realized what she really had there, and she wrote her own paper about it in 1981. She called it Asperger syndrome because she felt that autistic psychopathy would imply violent behavior. So she renamed it honoring the doctor who came up with it. So that was the start. But even more importantly, she took this idea of Asperger's syndrome and used it as powerful evidence that autism is not a single condition, but a spectrum of disorders, filling the gaps between Asperger's at one end of the spectrum and the most debilitating and heretofore only recognized form of autism at the other end. And so this led to the proper diagnosis of countless people who inhabited that middle segment, that unrecognized region in the middle. And many of them had dramatically different, different types. They were fairly distinct from each other, but they all still shared the same autism roots. And she led to that recognition. And that, of course, led to the official reclassification of autism to autism spectrum disorder in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is used by professionals in the United States for classifying mental health problems. So an amazing contribution from Dr. Lorna Wing really changed our entire conception of what autism is. And so remember Lorna Wing? Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing decreased activation in the primary somatosensory cortices of the brain.
Will do, man.
Interesting.
Check.
All right. Thank you, Bob. Kara, this is an interesting topic. You know, I think we're probably overdue for tackling this. Concussions in the NFL.
Oh, boy.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, guys, you know, this Sunday, tomorrow, actually, as of the date that this airs, the Carolina Panthers are going to take on the Denver Broncos in Super Bowl 50. Woo-hoo. 50.
Oh, yeah. It's 50. A big 5-0.
Yeah.
Years of professional concussions.
So, yeah, I wonder how prevalent in the players' minds the risk of concussion is going to be that day. You know, during the regular season games, the NFL said that Friday there were 182 reported concussions this season, a 58% increase from a year ago.
Whoa. That's huge. Why such a huge increase?
They don't say why. Nobody has reported on why, but it could be just that more people are reporting.
Is it like autism where the casting net is finer and they're just...
Could be. You know, more people are aware of it. More people are reporting it.
The NFL has new on-field rules about concussion protocols in which they are required to test players during the game. And more players, I think, than ever this past year have been pulled out of games to go through that.
There you go.
Through that testing. So I'm sure it has to do with
that. Well, it might be an artifact of increased surveillance, but there are actual factors too. The two things that frequently are brought up, one is that as football is increasingly a passing game, that, you know, the wide receivers are getting crushed, you know, and cornerbacks as well.
They're exposed. They can't protect
themselves. They're more exposed. And also just the size and power of players has become incredible. A team from today, if they played a team from 40 years ago, right, the beginning of the NFL, it'd be no contest. The forces involved with players crashing into each other now is just much greater than it was previously.
Yeah, and I mean, if we're comparing season to season, right, this past season to the season before, that could also just be a statistical anomaly. It could just be that there were more concussions last season than the year before. So I think it's hard to have any full understanding of that change. It could be more reporting. It could be just the natural progression of the game based on how it's played. And it could be a statistical fluke. But regardless of that, really interesting thing that I stumbled upon this week is a survey by the Associated Press. So they decided, a bunch of reporters banded together and interviewed 100 active NFL players to ask them about their opinions about concussion in the game. And there were some really interesting findings by this survey. So less than half of the players, only 39 out of 100 of the ones that were interviewed, said that they're more concerned about the long-term effects of concussion than other kinds of injuries. So of the remaining 61, 20 of them said that they aren't concerned at all, or that they're less concerned about concussion than they are about other injuries. And 41 said that the concern is equal for all injuries. So even though I think culturally and societally we are seeing a big shift, especially after a lot of amazing reporting, you guys probably remember the book League of Denial by the brothers Mark and Stephen Finaru. So they wrote this incredible book, The League of Denial, and then Frontline did an incredible expose based on that book of the way that the NFL really has mishandled through the years these claims of concussion-related injury. So, you know, there's been a lot of great reporting on this. I think there's more and more understanding of what CTE is, which we'll get to in a second, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. But it does seem like there's still a slow sea change happening within the NFL itself. So I have a few quotes from some active players that will just like blow your mind. Nikita Whitlock, a New York Giants special teamer, said, quote, "Personally, I don't think about head injuries. They don't affect me. I wonder, what are my joints going to be like in 20 years? How will my knees hold up in 20 years? What about my shoulders and wrists? These are the real weak points of your body." We've got a quote from Oakland Raiders running back James Olawale, who said, "Not worried. I think it's blown out of proportion." We've got a quote here from Houston Texans cornerback Charles James, who says, "You can get a head injury from anywhere. A dude could sucker punch me and I could get the same injury I get from hitting a running back head on." There's still, I think, a bit of a lack of understanding of the risks that are happening during games, during practice. I think there's still a change that needs to happen within the culture. But other people in this survey did say, you know, you get less sideways glances in the locker room if you're pulled out after you get your head hit. You know, people kind of make fun of you less if you decide to sit out or if you're asked to sit out because of a head injury. So I think there is a change happening within the system, but not as quickly as we'd like to see it.
Along those lines, one of the, I think, cultural changes that has to happen is how long players are kept out after a concussion.
Yeah, oh, huge.
Yeah, I mean, they used to go right back into the game. Now maybe they're kept out that game, but they're back in the next week. And the evidence really is mounting that there's a vulnerable period after a concussion. It obviously, you know, concussions occur along a spectrum. People say, well, when will I get better and how severe is it? I treat a lot of concussion. And it's like, it absolutely depends. It could be one day or it could be never. You know, it's the entire spectrum. It all depends on exact, there's no milestones. It's where, however severe the concussion was. But generally speaking, you want to be pretty much over the previous concussion before you put yourself at risk for getting more. If you get a second concussion while you're still recovering from the previous one, the injury is much worse.
Why, Steve? So what's happening?
Just imagine your brain cells are still recovering. So now you have these injured brain cells that are not 100% and they get traumatized again. They don't weather the damage as well. So they get much more, they're more vulnerable. They get more damaged. So probably players still, because most of the time players after a concussion will be back the next week. Mm-hmm. That's probably not long enough for a lot of these concussions.
And historically, like you said, they would go literally right back into the game. You'd pull them out. Can you follow my finger? Are you responsive? You know, and sometimes what we're seeing is that these diagnoses of things like chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which can really only happen at autopsy, happen as the result of multiple kind of asymptomatic subconcussions, like these things that aren't really diagnosable on the field. It's just like a lot of head trauma.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't really have any sort of effects. So it's really tough to know how long the brain has to recover if just playing a regular game of football, if you're having this kind of injury and the brain has to recover. It's complicated. And we're seeing CTE in kids. I mean, that's a big deal. So I thought maybe before we wrap up on this or talk more about it, that we can make sure that everybody understands what CTE is. So I found kind of the definition from Boston University, which is, you know, the preeminent research on CTE is happening there. It's where it was first described. They have a CTE center. So chronic traumatic encephalopathy is a progressive degenerative disease of the brain found in athletes and others with a history of repetitive brain trauma, including, like I said, symptomatic concussions as well as asymptomatic subconcussive hits to the head. It's been known to affect boxers since the 20s. However, recent reports have been published of neuropathologically confirmed CTE in retired professional football players and other athletes who have a history of repetitive brain trauma. It triggers progressive degeneration of the brain tissue, including buildup of an abnormal protein called tau. And these changes in the brain can begin months, years, or even decades after the last brain trauma or end of active athletic involvement. It's associated with memory loss, confusion, impaired judgment, impulse control problems, aggression, depression, and eventually progressive dementia. And so you'll see that sometimes these symptoms will mimic dementia and Alzheimer's, or sometimes you'll even see symptoms that mimic ALS.
Wow.
Yeah. So in boxing, you say it was this was known from the 20s. It was called dementia pugilistica.
Nice. Yeah. It wasn't described as CTE until much more recently.
Yeah. Yeah. So we knew about this. Yeah. But you know, boxing is a little different because the point of boxing is to pummel somebody into unconsciousness.
In the head.
Yeah. Yeah. So they go, they would become punch drunk.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, that's where that comes from.
And that's a good sort of rule of thumb is if that you were hit in the head hard enough to almost knock you out or to actually knock you out, that's hard enough to cause a concussion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at least with football, it's not the intention to knock people out, but it still is a consequence of the of just how violent and the forces involved with the game.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and just the strongest, biggest dudes, oftentimes leading with their helmets, even though they're not supposed to. It's a hard habit to break.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because many, many years ago, that was never even on anybody's radar. Oh, yeah. So this was, of course, in the news, I think, following, you know, just recently, a member of the Giants' 2012 Super Bowl championship team died at the age of 27. Tyler Sash. He was diagnosed with CTE at autopsy. Pro Football Hall of Famer Junior Seau, you know, he committed suicide. He was found to have CTE on autopsy. San Francisco 49ers linebacker Chris Borland suddenly retired, thought to have CTE. Mm-hmm. And if you just do a search, I basically, right before we got on air, I did a quick Google News search for CTE in the NFL. And Ken Stabler, this like literally just happened, this football great, he just died of cancer at the age, I think, of 69. But on autopsy, they found that he was stage 3 out of 4 of CTE. And I tried to find a comprehensive list. And the only thing I could find was on Wikipedia. So I'm not sure, you know, how much I trust it, but it's pretty insane. There's a list of dozens of players with confirmed CTE post-mortem, because you can really only confirm it at autopsy. And then there's a list of a few more players suspected of having suffered from CTE because they had ALS or dementia diagnoses that seem to mimic CTE. And there's also a list of many dozens of individuals that are alive today who seem to have these kinds of symptoms, including Steve Gleason, who I've been in contact with over the years via social media. He does a great ALS foundation and talks a lot about this. And then the crazy thing is there's a list of former players listed as plaintiffs in lawsuits against the NFL for concussion-related injuries. Thousands.
Thousands.
Thousands. Yep. It just goes and goes and goes. It's a huge problem. And it's not just in the NFL. It's also in college sports. It's in high school sports.
Yeah,
and
sure.
We now know it's hockey, as young as peewee sports.
Soccer.
We once talked on the show about in like 100 years, what thing that we accept today are they going to find barbaric? And I think this is on the list. That
football.
Just contact sports that are, you know, actually injuring people and causing brain damage, you know, to this level. You know, I could see, you know, 100 years from now thinking of this like the gladiatorial games. You know, like, really? You will people punch each other until one of them fell down unconscious? Really?
Yeah.
That was a sport? You know, beating each other up? You know?
yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting to think about that.
People.
So, Jay, I understand. We talked last week when you weren't here about the Zika virus, and already there are some conspiracy theories about this. It's not a new virus, but the virus that's becoming new in our awareness.
Yeah, again, guys, just to give a quick overview of what it is, I think it's important for people to have a good understanding of what the virus is and what it can do. So the World Health Organization declared that the Zika virus is a global public health emergency. Now, this doesn't mean go out and get all the bread and milk that you can get your hands on. You just have to educate yourself on what the virus is and what it can do. So a new update is that they suspect that the virus can be passed by having sexual contact, but the virus is largely passed through a mosquito bite. It's uncommon for patients to die, which is great. Only about 1 in 5 people show any symptoms, and the symptoms are mild fever, conjunctivitis, which is red or sore eyes, headache, joint pain, or rash. Now, the problem here is, in a nutshell, so there is a connection between the virus and Guillain-Barré syndrome. And now this can cause temporary paralysis, and you know this has been linked to the viral infection. There is no drug treatment for it, and there's no vaccine
for the infection.
For the infection,
not for Guillain-Barré, but
that's correct. Yeah. They're saying if you do get sick, you know, treat it like any you know, flu symptoms, rest, plenty of fluids. But the problem is, and the biggest concern here is that if a mother carrying an unborn child gets the virus, this could lead to microcephaly, which is when babies are born with smaller than normal head sizes. If you're pregnant, in particular, use insect repellents, cover up with long sleeves, you know, keep your skin covered, and keep your doors and windows and everything closed. You know, you just want to limit your exposure to any mosquito. Be very careful. The mosquitoes lay their eggs in standing water, so like even an old thing that you kept flowers in outside that has rainwater in it, that's bad. That's a breeding ground for mosquitoes. You don't want to have any of that lying around your house. And they're also saying that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control has said that pregnant women should not travel to affected areas. Just please be very careful. That, you know, you don't want your unborn child to have any complications. So sacrifice your time and energy now. Educate yourself as best you can and stay inside if you can. So now that we all understand what the virus is, there is a claim that the Zika virus outbreak is actually caused by the release of a genetically modified mosquito that was created by a British company called Oxitec.
Oh,
very interesting conspiracy theory and very complicated. I'm not going to go into all the details because we could spend an hour just talking about the fake science that the claim is propping up. But let me give you the quick 1-2. The conspiracy theorists are implying that GMO mosquitoes were released in Brazil where there is a significant Zika outbreak. Now, I don't think anyone will be surprised to learn that Mike Adams over at Natural News is in full conspiracy mode. He published a blog post in February. Oh, I love this guy. I can't help but love him because he's so zany.
I can.
He published a blog post on February 1st going into great details to first slap himself on the back for warning the world of the dangers of GMO pollution, as he calls it, and for being one of the smartest people that he's ever met. Now, that was a joke. He goes on to quote the Daily Mirror as a source for his information. His source is the Daily Mirror.
Yeah.
That's his source for the information. Another news outlet.
You can always stop there with the Daily Mirror.
And, correct. You know, Daily Mirror is not a good source of pretty much anything. Mirror, yeah. So another website called The Ecologist claims that the mass media has admitted the virus is caused by the GMO mosquitoes. So why is the theory wrong? What's going on here? First, the GMO mosquitoes were not released where the outbreak occurred. Mosquitoes can't travel as far away as they would have to go in order to be the mosquitoes that were biting people and spreading the virus. They simply can't travel that far, and they don't live long enough to get there. Second, the GMO mosquitoes were a test to see if the sterile males, because the mosquitoes that were genetically modified were males, if these sterile males would decrease the mosquito population numbers. The fact is they did. They decreased the mosquito population in the test areas over 90%. And the third, there is an amazingly complicated and scientifically void explanation as to how the mosquitoes are the actual causes of the virus. And I'm sorry, but you're going to have to read this on your own because it's just way too much information to go into. But suffice to say, the process that the conspiracy theorists are claiming is utterly and complete nonsense. It doesn't hold any validity scientifically. And one last quick point, the GMO mosquitoes that were made are all males, and male mosquitoes don't bite. Let that sink in for a second. The GMO mosquitoes don't bite. These are males.
Jay, there's a few other conspiracies I wanted to just quickly mention. I don't know if you came across these. So one is that this, by the way, comes from Tara Smith. You guys remember her. She's been on our show a number of years ago. She writes the blog Etiology. She's a infectious disease doctor. So another one is that the rise in Brazilian babies born with microcephaly is due to the Tdap vaccine. So they're blaming it on vaccines, even though that vaccine isn't given until later in the pregnancy after the brain's already developed largely and wouldn't cause microcephaly. So it just doesn't make any medical sense. Or another one is that this is an intentional – they always say this is an intentional infection for some reason, something to do with Rockefeller or something because bioterrorism. You know, there's no coherent thing there. It's just
purposefully
somebody's doing it on purpose. Yeah. Another one is that it's all made to get us – it's a ploy to make us get the Zika vaccine. Problem with that is that there isn't a Zika vaccine, so I'm not sure how that works. But yeah, those are just the crazy shit that people are saying. making stuff up.
Yeah, so guys, you know, just keep in mind, you know, keep yourself educated on the virus. Things might change. The virus might evolve. And because there is, you know, a connection here to it having an effect on unborn children, God, if you are pregnant or if your wife is pregnant or you know someone that's pregnant, please educate them and help them learn about how to protect themselves.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Kara, let me ask you a question. Have you ever had a mud wrap?
A mud wrap? No.
Or like a spa mud treatment?
I've had a scrub at a spa and I've had plenty of massages, but I've never had a mud wrap. That sounds kind of gross to me.
Well, they wrap you in mud and then they wrap cellophane around the mud. And then they wrap you in multiple layers of towels and clothing.
Well, the crazy thing is this stuff is expensive and I'd rather pay for somebody to like massage me than someone to slap mud on me and then wrap me in plastic.
Yeah, but you gotta suck out all the toxins or something.
Oh, yeah. I only pay for things in the spa that feel good.
And then you have to sit in a hot room for 9 hours during the summer. Oh. And to make sure
brisket.
I don't think that's typical.
And we're going to stick your head in a cardboard box.
What?
What's that?
What?
What spa is this?
Well, this is a spa in Quebec this was their treatment. It was kind of like a spiritual treatment. And what I just described, that's what they were offering to their clients. One client in particular, Chantal Levine, did this for 9 days in the summer, 9 hours, for 9 hours in the summer, mud, cellophane, multiple layers, head in a box. And she became profoundly dehydrated, which shouldn't be a shock to anybody.
Yeah.
Had to be rushed to the hospital where her organs started shutting down one by one, and then she eventually died. So,
oh, no.
It's, you know, to me, this is not a spa treatment. This is a form of torture.
Yes.
That predictably resulted in a horrible medical outcome. Unfortunately, you know, sadly, an actual person died from this. So recently, the spa workers that were involved with this episode were sentenced to prison for their negligence. They received between 2 and 3 years in prison.
What?
Which seems like a slap on the wrist to me, to be honest with you.
Oh my gosh.
Given that what they did resulted in somebody's death. This isn't the first time that kind of thing happened. I think we spoke about this in 2011.
Yes, we have.
James Ray. Yeah, it was a guru, had a sweat lodge kind of thing.
Yeah.
But had three people die from dehydration because of the sweat lodge.
Mm.
So, a couple of points I want to make about this. You know, one, obviously, you know, don't subject yourself to extreme treatments just because some guru or spa person is telling you that it's a good idea. Anything that would make you that dehydrated is dangerous. Dehydration is not good for your body. In fact, you're talking about sports, you know, it's not uncommon for coaches to push their athletes too far, especially if it's hot weather and their athletes sweat a lot. If they don't hydrate sufficiently, you could actually damage your kidneys. Kidneys are very sensitive to dehydration. You know, they don't function very much. It's the responsibility of anybody who's doing anything like this to make sure that they're not putting the people under their care at any health risk. But you're putting your hands in somebody who's a quack. You know, I mean, they have no medical training. They're just a guru who's giving you some bizarre treatment. You know, I think you have to think very carefully about the qualifications and whether or not they are going to be able to keep you safe through this. Clearly, I mean, this happens on a regular basis, so it's not like these are completely isolated incidents. And there's also a lot of milder manifestations of this. I wrote not too long ago about hot yoga. You guys ever hear of hot yoga?
Oh, yeah. Bikram. Mr. Bikram recently got sued for like a major sexual harassment suit. The guy who invented hot yoga.
Yeah.
Bikram yoga.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's basically exercising in an oppressively hot environment, you know, and that's supposed to somehow be invigorating. But again, it's like, it's not a good idea because it's just, you're going to get dehydrated. You're going to get overheated. You're going to get heat stroke. I like to exercise with a fan on me, to be honest with you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like it when it's hot in the gym.
Constantly hydrating during workout.
Yeah. You gotta hydrate and you gotta cool down. You gotta keep cool and hydrated. This is like the opposite.
Bikram's victim of sexual harassment just got a $7 million award.
Whoa. That's serious. That's not a slap on the
wrist. That's really serious. Yeah. That is not at all. Ugh. Hot yoga. That sounds horrible. Oh,
Yeah, but it's a fad. There's no science behind it. That's the other thing. People just make shit up, right? It's just like the guy who invented it. How did he invent it? You know, what? There's no evidence or science or research that says that this is, there's any advantage to this. It's just that, hey, this is different, and people say they like the way it feels. But, you know, if there's good basic medical reasons to suspect that this is not a good idea.
They wrap it into new age sort of wrapping to it to make it more appealing to people who are allured by such eye candy.
Steve, is there any benefit to exercising in elevated temperatures, like as far as the workout or the quality of the workout?
No.
Because people talk about like sweating more.
We've talked about that.
You know, they wear the sauna suits and then they just go sit in a hot room like in a trash bag and then they just sweat a lot. I think it's that you like actually physically weigh less after you use a after you lose a bunch of water weight, but that's not healthy.
Yeah, it's not good for you at all.
It's not. I mean, if you want to like make weight for like a wrestling tournament, I could.
Oh gosh.
I mean, it would.
Yeah, then that would make a little more sense. I don't think it's healthy, but like it doesn't even. It blows my mind when people are like,
"No,
I lost 5 pounds," and I'm like, "Yeah, but you don't look any different because you just lost a bunch of water weight."
That's a gimmick too. Yeah, it's like, look, you've lost weight. You've been, you just shrunk your tissue from dehydration. It's just not good. It's not a good way to lose weight either. You know, your muscles need water to function. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses.
Kara, did you know that The Great Courses offers tons of different videos and audio that you can watch to educate yourself?
I did know that.
Not only do they have a huge library, which everybody should be dipping into, they cover science, history. I mean, Evan, cooking. Are you an expert cook?
Oh, gosh, by no means, but I'm willing to learn.
I think one of my favorite Great Courses video is The Inexplicable Universe, Unsolved Mysteries. You love him, Neil deGrasse Tyson. You know, he's everyone's favorite astrophysicist. And he talks about all sorts of cosmic wonders like black holes, quantum foam, string theory, all the things that Bob loves. And he makes them totally understandable to people like me who do not have a background in astrophysics.
I hear you can watch it absolutely free right now, but you have to go to the Great Courses Plus. It's a limited time offer. We're offering SGU listeners a chance to stream Neil deGrasse Tyson's course, The Inexplicable Universe, Unsolved Mysteries, and it's a $95 value, but right now it is free.
It's so versatile, guys. You could stream it from any internet connected device, TV, PC. You can go through the Great Courses Plus apps.
Whoa!
Plus, remember, this free offer is only available for a limited time, so kind of hurry.
To stream The Inexplicable Universe from The Great Courses Plus for free, you must go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show. All right, Bob, I understand that NASA has established a planetary defense system.
Yes, get ready for a slew of acronyms and initialisms. NASA has finally listened to me, no they didn't, and has made a serious move to deal with potential asteroid or comet impacts on Earth.
Oh, I thought it was for like alien invasion or something.
Yeah, right. It sounds awesome, though. It has created the Planetary Defense Coordination Office, which is one of the best names of any office that I am aware of. It's known as the PDCO. It is tasked with finding and dealing with any and all PHOs, or potentially hazardous objects in space. I was just overjoyed with this news. Did you guys, were you guys just like really, really happy when you read that?
Oh, yeah.
And I should have actually even predicted this at the year-end wrap-up show. I'm kicking myself. But there's actually a lot of ways that we could have an ELE, or extinction-level event, on Earth. Just read Phil Plait's Death from the Skies. You'll come across a plethora of them. We could experience a GRB, a gamma ray burst. Not fun. A supervolcano. There's no initialism for that. A supernova. An alien attack, even. And there would be essentially, there would be nothing that we could do for any of those. Nothing. Nope. Just kind of like sit back and try to enjoy it. But we could potentially do a lot to mitigate or remove the threat from an asteroid or comet impacts. And that's why I've really been stressing for years now that we really should be taking this seriously and do as much as we can. So I got a quote. The quote is, the formal establishment of the Planetary Defense Coordination Office makes it evident that the agency is committed to perform a leadership role in national and international efforts for detection of these natural impact hazards and to be engaged in planning if there is a need for planetary defense. That quote is from Lindley Johnson, who is the lead program executive of the PDCO. His official NASA job title is Planetary Defense Officer.
Does he have a uniform?
Planetary Defense Officer. Do I really need to say how cool that job title is? That is my. It's fantastic. So, Bob, what do you do? I'm the PDO. What's a PDO? I'm a Planetary Defense Officer. It's just so awesome. So, but NASA really hasn't been sitting on their hands up until now. They have been doing lots of stuff. And since they've been looking, they're actually confident that they found 90% of NEOs or near Earth objects a kilometer or bigger. But that last 10% really worries me. Let's find those guys. They're focusing more now on the intermediate sized ones, kind of maybe as big as a football field, which could still do a solid amount of damage. But they've only found about 25% of those. And their goal is to have that number up to 90% by 2020. And they've spent $70 million since 2010, which really isn't a lot of money. But now they have $50 million budget for 2016 alone, just for this new office. So they've got a huge influx of money to do what really needs to be done here. And they're going to need it because all told, they've found worldwide, they've identified, and not just NASA, I think everyone who is even looking, they've identified 14,000 near-Earth objects. But they estimate, the estimate is that the total could be in the millions. So there's a lot. Sure, the little tiny ones probably don't have to worry too much about those, but there's still many, many thousands that we would want to know about.
I mean, are we still talking about a once every 100 year kind of big catastrophic sort of thing happening? A Tunguska or the one that happened in 2012 in the Ukraine, something like that?
The range varies depending on the size. So the bigger it is, the rarer it is. But all it takes is one. And we know it's going to happen. There's no question it's going to happen. Just a matter of when. I mean, how many times have we seen an asteroid as it passes us by? Like, oh boy, look what almost hit us that we didn't see coming. So we got to look for this stuff, especially, I mean, there's 10% of the NEOs out there that are a kilometer or bigger that we haven't identified yet. So that's scary as hell. So what are they going to do? So what have they been tasked to do? Basically, there's a few things that they're going to do. One of the main things is they're going to find and track and characterize these PHOs, these potentially hazardous objects. So to do that, they're going to oversee, this office is going to oversee, of course, NASA's own program to deal with this, which is called NASA's Near Earth Object Observation Program. So they're going to be overseeing that. They're also going to coordinate the observation efforts done by the National Science Foundation. The Space Situational Awareness Facilities of the United States Air Force are going to be working with them. And of course, they're going to work internationally. They're going to work with the European Space Agency, the ESA, their counterparts that work on NEOs, near-Earth objects, and other countries as well that are looking. They're going to try and work with everybody to coordinate and understand exactly, you know, what new threats are being identified. And also, the other big thing they're going to do is they're going to develop techniques to deflect or redirect these objects. So, for example, we've talked about this in the past, the ARM gravity tractor demo. These gravity tractors will, hover or go in orbit around these objects and use the gravitational pull alone, the mutual pull to slightly diverge the asteroid away from the Earth so that it misses the Earth. And this has tremendous advantages over other methods. There's also other things like asteroid impact and deflection assessments. For example, they're planning on a probe to study and assess the feasibility of using a kinetic impact to change the path or trajectory of an asteroid. They're working on plans to build an obelisk that will shoot a beam of force that will push the asteroid away. Oh, wait, sorry, that's a Star Trek plot. ignore that one. So, but also there's also, they're also looking at, well, what if we can't do anything? What if we find out there's an asteroid that's going to hit us in 1 month and there's nothing we could do? Well, they're also thinking about that as well. They're going to provide expert input to the, to FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency of the United States, and, their international counterparts so that they can coordinate emergency response operations. NASA also recently signed a charter with the United States FEMA to create a planetary impact emergency response working group so that they could all get together. They have like meetings a few times a year and discuss things that can be done if for a worst case scenario. And also finally, they will notify the media. They will not be keeping this information secret. You conspiracy people out there, you know who you are. They'll be providing timely and accurate information to the government, the media, and the public. They're going to let everybody know what's going on. And specifically for situations where they have a potentially hazardous object that poses a significant chance of impact to Earth, and that means greater than 1% chance over the next 100 years, they have an agreement that they're going to, the NASA administrator is going to notify the executive office of the president and the Congress and other government organizations so that they're aware as soon as possible that, hey, you know, this thing has a 1% chance of hitting us in 50 years. That's, you know, it doesn't sound urgent, but 1% is huge, and you don't ever even want to be in that situation. Imagine a 1 in 100 or 1 in 50 chance of having civilization destroyed. Not a good situation to be in. So that's the situation, guys. It's incredibly encouraging. I'm glad that they're taking it so seriously. They have an entire office dedicated to this, trying to coordinate efforts worldwide. And I think it's exactly what we need. We need to know what these threats are so that we can, if we have time, you know, if we catch these quick enough, if we've got like 10 or 15 years, we could really go into overdrive and produce multiple methods of trying to deal with this. And hopefully one will work. And I'm just very happy that they're doing this.
Yeah, I think this is a great idea because it's like insurance. The world will invest actually probably in overall a tiny amount of resources and money to develop a system that will prevent a rare but catastrophic event. Makes perfect sense. And, you know, there'll probably be some spin-off technology from this. It's not like the money will be completely wasted if we never have to protect ourselves. But also think about this, Bob. Think about, you know, the extinction level events, which are very unlikely. Inevitable, but only over the really long term. But imagine if just a medium-sized asteroid or meteor hit a city. You know, it wouldn't have to be that big to kill tens of thousands of people, cause trillions of dollars of damage.
Sure.
If it hit a major city. Yeah, imagine a Tunguska-level event over New York City.
Geez. Yeah. It would be devastating. And then, of course, think about this. That happens. It's not like everyone will immediately know, oh, that was an asteroid or a comet. It could be, oh, somebody nuked us. Russia nuked us or some other country. And it could cause, you know, a worldwide conflagration because it is misidentified. You know, but if we knew it was coming, there'd be no question. Even if it hits and destroys a city, at least we would know exactly what it was.
Yeah, that was very, very cool. Very, very cool. This is also cool, Evan.
Mm.
A little update on lab-grown meat, much anticipated. Jay, ooh. I know Jay's going to eat it.
As Steve said, we've mentioned on the show before, actually, that someday all these delicious meats that we now enjoy on our plates will perhaps be produced in laboratories instead of traditional farms and slaughterhouses and the things we've become accustomed to.
Yay, I want in vitro meat.
Yay. Indeed.
I'm so excited.
The news this week is that a company called Memphis Meats has brought us a step closer to that reality because for the first time in history, a meatball has been cooked and consumed using beef cells that did not require a cow to be slaughtered. Very cool. The idea is relatively simple to understand. If companies can produce meats without the need for large animal farms, then we wind up helping our environment out drastically by reducing the massive carbon emitting footprints that these farms produce. There are added bonuses as well, especially for those who identify with an ethical dilemma in killing animals for food and for other products, which would mean saying goodbye to the old ways of putting meat on the table. And other bonuses as well, a reduction in antibiotic use for the cows, a reduction in pathogens, which we find in our meats, and other contaminants, All these things could be controlled in the laboratory environment. That's the idea. But what our societies can't and won't adapt to lab-grown meats, they won't do it until, I think, two important criteria are met. Number one is the product itself. It has to look, smell, feel, and most importantly, taste like the meats we have grown accustomed to. And number two is that it has to be affordable. Not necessarily as in comparison exactly with current meat prices, but relatively close. It has to become affordable. But with the news of the Memphis meats this week, they seem to have successfully achieved criteria one. The meatball they produced was cooked up quite nicely by a master chef. It hit the hot skillet, behaved exactly the way a traditional meatball would behave. It browned up nicely. It sizzled in its juices. And the final verdict when it was consumed is that it tasted great and it was otherwise indistinguishable from a traditional meatball. Now, unfortunately, though, criteria two is still a long way away. The process Memphis Meats used to engineer the meatball costs about $18,000 per pound of product. so we're not there yet, but their estimates are in that approximately 3 years, they'll get it down to a point where it will become affordable, which is great.
Well, now, what's this process? Like $30,000. Right?
That was the Elon Musk funded burger. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So yep. We've come down at like $12,000.
We're already.
I heard that they were down to like $11 per hamburger. You know, this must be a different lab.
Hmm. Supposedly. I don't know. $11? I hadn't seen that.
That sounds crazy.
Yeah, Jay, you're talking about the lab in the Netherlands. They created the $325,000 burger in 2013. This is the lab run by Mark Post. And now he recently announced that he got the process down to $11 for one burger, or $80 per kilogram of meat. But he also says that he's still 20 to 30 years away from it being commercially viable because you still have to figure out a way to mass produce it. But I think that that's probably an overestimate, especially given this recent update.
Here's the process they use to create the meat as they describe it. So they say in order to grow meat in their labs, Memphis Meats begins by isolating cow and pig cells that have the ability to regenerate, and they provide the cells with oxygen and nutrients such as sugars and minerals. The cells develop inside bioreactor tanks into skeletal muscles that can be harvested in between 9 and 21 days. No animals are slaughtered in the making of the meats.
Slaughtered.
But the firm does use something called fetal bovine serum from unborn calves' blood to initiate the process. But
all right, that's a problem.
They're working on a typical
in labs.
Yeah, but they're working on a plant-based alternative that will replace the serum in the future. So that component of it, which I imagine a lot, you know, some people who have ethical issues with this would really object to, that part of it will hopefully be able to be replaced.
And it's a good thing they were using FBS and not HS. I used to, when I would keep my cell cultures, we would use fetal bovine serum and horse serum. And I don't think people would respond very well to their lab-grown meat being made with horse serum.
Not something you want in your advertising literature for the product, I would think.
Yeah.
They say that this cutting-edge technique produces 90% less greenhouse emissions, consumes less nutrients out of the product, and doesn't require antibiotics or other additives as are used in traditional meat production.
Yeah. Yep, yep.
So win everywhere. And
it's a win all around.
I'm as big a carnivore as there is out there, and I will look forward to consuming this if it passes all the tests.
You know what I'm most excited about with in vitro meat is eating like weird shit that you could never eat otherwise because it's totally unethical.
Like zebra?
Yeah, like zebra, because it only takes a punch biopsy. Like the animals don't have to be hurt.
I never thought about that.
Yeah. Or Soylent Green.
That's crazy.
I wonder, imagine if we could... Like if we have mammoth DNA, you could eat a mammoth burger.
A mammoth burger.
That'd be cool.
That'd be awesome.
Could you have, and you could make an oxymoron moron out of it, you could have mammoth sliders. That would be real.
Jumbo shrimp.
Jumbo shrimp.
Yes, exactly. Mammoth sliders, jumbo shrimp.
Mammoth sliders. I love it.
It's all good. So yeah, this is very good news, I think.
3 years. So it's like really like 20 years.
3 years.
Just saying.
Yeah, we'll see if they get that price point down. But it looks like solved they solved the part about making the product itself. It passed all those taste and smell and feel tests.
Right. All right. You know what, Jay? It feels like we haven't had a Who's That Noisy in a month.
We haven't. So, like, the first thing we should do is we should play back the last one. Do any of you guys remember this noisy?
God, no.
What was that? Would you believe that that is that whistling tone that you hear? Is actually lightning in Jupiter's atmosphere.
Whoa.
Cool.
Ooh.
What the hell?
What recorded that?
Voyager.
Awesome. Oh, Voyager did.
Really? Yeah. Before it became sentient?
Yeah, this is way before.
V'ger.
V'ger. Yeah, before the whole V'ger thing.
Yeah.
V'ger.
Yeah, that's cool.
They call that a whistler, and it's one part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And that's a pretty epic sound that was captured. Believe it or not, somebody actually guessed this. Casey Miller actually was the only person to guess correctly.
All right.
That's awesome.
So congratulations, Casey. Now, I have a new sound for you guys. I thought this was really interesting. It might sound familiar to you, but there's a interesting twist to what this is. Please. Okay.
I know
Before
what it
you
is.
Say anything, there is something oddly familiar about that sound.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people will have like a back of the mind, you know, something familiar about that. What is that? What is that noise I've heard many times before?
It's R2-D2 on a bad day.
No. So if you have a guess, if you have any good Who's That Noisy suggestions, if you just want to say hi, write to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right, Kara, what's the word?
Ooh, what is the word? Ooh, the word today is a fun one because how many times have you guys read a word over and over in, I don't know, an article or in a textbook, and then you kind of just invented how you should say it in your head? And then later when you looked up the real pronunciation, it was completely different than what you thought? That's
six.
Always fun.
Never.
Yeah, six. Exactly six. So the word today is epistasis, which I have always read as epistasis.
Yeah, that's how I would pronounce it in my head.
Yeah, but then I looked it up and there is no pronunciation guide anywhere on the internet that says epistasis. There's like 50 epistasis. That say epistasis.
Wow.
Yeah.
Epistasis. So the word's almost like epistaxis, which is pronounced epistaxis, except it's...
And it's Yeah.
yeah, it's one letter
its wiki
off.
Page even says not to be confused with epistaxis.
Yeah.
So yeah, epistasis.
Which is a nosebleed, by the way.
Yes, interesting. So this makes the third definition that I'm going to read you extra funny. So wait for that.
Okay.
All right, the first definition is the one that I think the listener who recommended this was looking for, which is a genetics definition. It's probably the most often used that I've come across in the literature. So this is a form of interaction between non-allelic genes in which one combination of those genes has a dominant effect over other combinations, which makes no sense. So more clearly, let me tell you, it's when one gene locus, so one part of a gene on one little spot, masks or modifies the phenotype of another gene locus. So when we think back to learning genetics, and we usually learn Mendelian genetics, those classical Punnett squares, where we're talking about a seed that's either smooth or wrinkly, and it can be a dominant or a recessive trait, and we do the little Punnett cross and we figure it out that the offspring have a 1-to-2-to-1 ratio of these homozygous or heterozygous traits. Maybe you're not even following me here, but think back to middle school biology. What we're talking about when we talk about epistasis is when two genes are not independent of one another. They actually have an effect over each other where the outcome is greater than the sum of the parts. So one gene can actually mask the other gene. One gene can affect the other gene. And so the phenotype or the outcome, the way that the organism looks or the way that the organism acts is based upon this combination of the two genes. Does that make sense to everybody?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not simply Mendelian. It's a complicated interaction.
It's a complicated interaction. A good example that I came across was like, you might have a gene for red hair and another person has a gene for brown hair. But if you both have the gene for baldness, you're not going to have red hair or brown hair. You're going to have no hair. So that's like a good example of these genes interacting with other genes and kind of trumping them in that way or changing them in that way. But now in medicine, there are two definitions. One is the one that you just used, Steve, the stoppage of a secretion or a discharge.
Mm-hmm.
So epistasis is that secretion or discharge stopping. The second one, the scum that forms on a urine specimen when it's standing.
Whoa. Yeah.
Which is why it's so funny to me that it's pronounced epistasis. So
you need a word for that?
Yeah, apparently that's like a legit word. So if
you just call it pee scum,
piss scum. Yeah. Well, next time you can like say to the nurse, like, too much epistasis on the sample. Like, what are you
pissed
talking
on what
about?
Now?
So, this word actually comes from medical Latin. Epistasis really means the checking of a discharge, which makes sense, right? With the stopping of the secretion or the discharge, like the nosebleed. That comes from the Greek epistasis, which is a stopping or a stoppage or a halting. So if you break it down, epi is upon, which we see that all the time in science words. And then stasis or stasis is a stopping or a standing, which makes sense, right? Stasis. Stopping something. Yeah, it's static, exactly. Its genetic usage was actually coined in 1909 by William Bateson. He's a British geneticist who lived between 1861 and 1926, and he established the term epistasis to explain that genetic interaction of two independent traits.
Cool.
Pretty interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I like it when the science words have multiple meanings. But I would have bet anything it was epistasis.
Me too. It blew my mind because I was like, I know that I'm not wrong. And I checked both the North American and the English pronunciations across the board.
Not just a British thing.
Epistasis.
Yeah, I mean, you put the accent on that syllable, but it's the word stasis, I guess, that gets stuck in our mind. We want to say stasis because we're used to that.
Right.
Epistasis.
Yeah, like homeostasis. Yeah. Like you wouldn't say homeostasis.
Yeah, homeostasis.
That would be weird.
Aluminium. Oh, wait. That's some people do pronounce that.
So who decided its pronunciation?
Well, I don't know, but everybody agrees on
somebody
it, apparently.
Did.
Society.
Probably
maybe
good
knows
old.
It, and it gets accepted.
Good old William Bateson. He was British, so maybe when he coined the term, the pronunciation stuck across the board.
Just one more quick break to remind you to take the very important survey at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com. This is a survey by the company that hosts our advertising. It's a great opportunity to give important feedback, to let them know how you feel about the SGU, and so that they can get to understand our audience a little bit better. So please take the survey now. It only takes about 3 minutes to do the survey, and it will really help the show. So we appreciate you taking the time. So once again, that is podcastone.com to take the SGU listener survey.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have just 3 regular news items this week. Jay, you missed a good theme last week.
What was it?
It was the Zika virus was the theme.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's why we recently talked about Zika virus.
Yeah.
It's on Science or Fiction.
But here we just got 3 news items. Is everybody ready?
Yep.
All right. Here we go. Item number 1, researchers at MIT have created a new RFID chip that is virtually impossible to hack. Item number 2, a new study contradicts prior conclusions, finding there is no evidence that radiation from X-rays and CT scans cause cancer. And item number three, a newly published computer simulation supports the conclusion that both Jupiter and Saturn significantly protect the inner solar system from comets, making life on Earth possible. And by that, of course, I mean, you know, keeps us from getting smacked with comets every 10,000 years or whatever.
So we don't need that new organization that Bob just spoke about, I suppose.
It's just comets, not asteroids.
Oh, okay. All right.
Jay, go first.
All right. So the one about MIT creating the unhackable RFID chip, it's hard to comment on because I would need a lot more information about the idea of it being, you know, impossible. They say it's virtually impossible to hack. That's a huge claim. But then I'm like wondering, when you say hack, you know, how can you hack it? Are you going to pretend that it's another chip or whatever? There's just details I don't have that would really help me understand what the real meaning is. So I'm going to put that one on hold for a second. This idea about CAT scans, you know, x-rays and CAT scans that they cause cancer, or people thought they may cause cancer. You know, you hear like if you go into an airplane, it's kind of like getting, you know, certain number of x-rays worth of radiation. And then now they're saying, so this thing you're saying is a new study contradicts these previous conclusions. That would be fantastic if it's true. And I see no reason why I wouldn't believe that a study, you know, a recent study of the data or of new data collected would contradict that. So, okay, I can see that one being legit. All right, so this other one here about a computer simulation that says that both Jupiter and Saturn significantly protect the inner solar system from comets and whatnot. So, I mean, what are we talking about here? Is it that their gravitational fields are strong and that it would pull in this debris and it wouldn't hit the Earth? But the reason why I'm not too keen on this one, the first thing I thought of when Steve said it was that for the most part, our planets, you know, the planets are not close to each other. You know, you can't think of Jupiter and Saturn as like a big vacuum cleaner for our solar system because our solar system is freaking enormous. And it just doesn't seem to make much sense that they'd be pulling in like tons of debris because they're only really creating a significant gravity well in a very, very small portion of the solar system. So I'm leaning towards this one, and partially because this one sounds so cool and reasonable, but I think it has a hidden fakeness to it. The RFID one is really bothering me. An unhackable RFID chip. Yeah, I have to go with the Jupiter and Saturn as the fake.
Okay, Evan?
Oh, the RFID chip. Impossible to hack. Virtually impossible to hack. I think virtually probably is the key word in there. They've minimized it, supposedly, and, you know, to a point where it's you know, almost zero. I'm not surprised if that is the case. I'm tending that this one is science. We've known about this problem with the RFID chips for a while now. It's been probably, I don't know, they've been in use for a decade, I would think, if not maybe a little longer. And we've known about the vulnerabilities associated with it. So, yeah, that researchers and scientists are coming up with better RFIDs. I'm not surprised there. The next one. A new study contradicts prior conclusions, finding there is no evidence that radiation from x-rays and CAT scans cause cancer. So I need to just clarify this or get clarification. There was a prior conclusion. The prior conclusion was that perhaps x-rays and CAT scans cause cancer, but this new study shows no evidence that x-rays and CAT scans cause cancer. Do I have that right,
Steve? That's what it says.
Okay. You know, causing cancer, you have to be exposed to so much of it, wouldn't you?
And of course, you know, that shorthand for it statistically increases your odds of getting cancer, right? Doesn't mean if you get one x-ray, you guaranteed 100% get cancer.
Just means it
increases
that.
Your risk, yeah.
Yeah. I may have a little problem with this one. But the last one, supporting the conclusion that Jupiter and Saturn significantly protect the inner solar system, it supports that conclusion. Making life on Earth possible. Well, we're going back to the point. This one's a little tricky, I think. There used to be a ton of stuff out there, and yes, the outer planets did protect the inner solar system, making life on Earth possible. Well, you know, helping make life on Earth possible wasn't the only indicator. Gosh, it's either this one or the X-rays and CAT scans. I'll say that it's the Jupiter and Saturn one. I'll say that one's the fiction. I don't think that that was the conclusion that was reached in the study.
Okay, Bob. Okay. The RFID chip. That I don't have that much of a problem with that one. Sure, I could totally buy that they made a chip that is incredibly hard to hack. Virtually impossible. You know, that's strong. That's pretty damn strong, as Jay said. But I could buy that much more than the other two, which is probably what you want me to think. But going to the x-rays, yeah, on its own, that the x-ray one, just like, what? How could we not be, how could we have been wrong about that? It just doesn't make sense that we could be so far off. There could be some tricky wording here. Maybe, yeah, that one's really, it's really hard not to just jump to that one and say, yes, that's fiction. But I think I'm going to join the crew and go with Jupiter and Saturn. And, yeah, I've heard for years that Jupiter and Saturn have protected the Earth, but I never really thought of, you know, what Jay said, that, yeah, the solar system is huge. The comets can come from so many different directions and just not even be near Jupiter. So the protection, seems like it shouldn't necessarily be anything near significant protection. So yeah, I'm going to say that one's fiction as well.
And Kara.
I totally think the RFID chip that's virtually impossible to hack sounds reasonable. It's something that I'm sure people have been working on for a long time. MIT got some smart folks over there. I'm going to go with that's science. The new study contradicting prior conclusions, finding that there's no evidence that radiation from x-rays and CT scans cause cancer, is bananarama to me. I mean, a study could say anything, a single study. So, like, unfortunately, this one could be science too. I mean, I think it's fiction. My gut says that this is fiction, because how could a study come out that says that x-rays don't cause cancer? I mean, it's x-ray radiation. Like, we know x-rays cause cancer. Ugh, that's annoying. And then the newly published computer simulation supports the conclusion that both Jupiter and Saturn significantly protect the inner solar system from comets, making life on Earth possible. I think that one's science. I think that the x-ray one is the fiction. I really think that it's crazy to me that a study would say x-rays don't cause cancer.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. I can't disagree with that.
But it's
at all.
Almost too obvious. You know what
That's
I mean?
It.
It's like,
That's
oh,
what I'm
it's too obvious. Uh-huh. But I'm going to go with it anyway, because I don't want to get caught up in trickery.
All right. Well, you all agree.
Trickery.
Pretty confidently, it seems, on the first one. Researchers at MIT have created a new RFID chip that is virtually impossible to hack. You all think this one is science, and this one is.
Say
science.
It. Yes.
Yay.
All right.
Oh.
So this is interesting. Yeah, those smart guys at MIT. One of the primary ways that people can hack into RFID chips. So these are chips that send out an infrared signal, and it's like you can have it on your credit card. And a lot of credit cards now do have chips on them rather than the magnetic strips. Have you had that before? Mm-hmm. You have to put your card in with the chip rather than the strip.
It's really annoying. Like, I get that it's helpful, but it takes forever.
The problem is somebody could sit next to you with a device and they could hack into that chip on your credit card and get all your information.
I thought it was supposed to be more secure than the strip.
Well, but they're not totally secure. One of the methods that they use is called the side channel attack. And essentially, every time it pings your chip, and there's a little bit of a leak of information every time it cycles through. Even if it's encrypted and it's not giving away the information, every time you ping it, there's a tiny little leak of information, and you could do it thousands of times and reconstruct the ID from the chip that way. So that's a side channel attack. It's way around the encryption. So they found a way to thwart that method. The chip uses a random number generator and gives itself a new ID, which it coordinates with the reader, so that you can't do 1,000 pings of it. It'll keep shifting the ID, so you'll never build up information about what the ID is.
Oh, cool.
It doesn't have a static ID. It has a changing ID which is run from a random number generator. So that would completely thwart that. However, there is a way around that or any method like that called the power glitch attack. Now, RFID chips are not self-powered. They get the power from the reader.
The power.
So what a power glitch attack does is it turns off the chip right before it's about to cycle. So you can do a side channel attack and then to take the power, create a power glitch, take the power away from the chip before it gives itself a new number. And that way you can do 1,000, iterations without it ever going through a full cycle and giving itself a new number. And it gives you the ability to do the side channel attack. So in addition to prevent that, they had to thwart the power glitch attack. They did that by putting a power supply on the chip itself. So it has like a little capacitor that could store a little bit of power, right? So it basically charged up the capacitor from the external source. And then if the power goes off, it stores the information from that last little bit of power that it has. And so that when it powers back up, it remembers where it was. It doesn't reset.
Nice. So
it would completely thwart the power glitch attack. So by thwarting simultaneously the side channel attack and the power glitch attack, they say that this chip is quote unquote virtually impossible to hack. Of course, until somebody develops an entirely new and unanticipated way of hacking it, but at least it thwarts the known hacks. Pretty neat.
Yeah. Thank you, MIT.
Clever. Yes.
Very clever. All right, let's go on to number two. A new study contradicts prior conclusions, finding there is no evidence that radiation from X-rays and CT scans cause cancer. Kara, who arguably has the greatest biological background in the group, thinks that this is the fiction. The rest of the guys don't see anything wrong with this. They think this one is science.
Oh, that's perfectly right.
Shit.
And this one is science.
Yeah.
That kills me.
How? Explain this.
But I did say one study can say anything.
Yeah, yeah. But this is pretty devastating. But this is Kara. Amazing. Don't feel bad. It's the thing is, like, when I know the same area of science that you know, I'm better at predicting what's weird, right? So if something strikes me as, wow, boy, that's a good one, you're more likely to fall for it if you know why I think it's a good item. But anyway, that's why I get bobble up.
Yes, you bastard.
There's something known as the linear no threshold phenomenon. Does that sound familiar to you, Kara?
Linear no threshold. No threshold phenomenon.
It's just what it says, LNT. So years ago, scientists studied the effects of radiation, and they found that there was a dose response curve in terms of dose of radiation increasing the risk of developing cancer, and it followed an LNT, or linear no threshold, model, which meant that the lower the dose, the lower the risk in a linear fashion, but it never goes away entirely. So that's why there's the no threshold bit. It goes all the way down to zero. So there's essentially no safe level of radiation where there is a zero risk of increasing your risk of cancer. There's no threshold. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So all later research looking at the risk of X-rays and CAT scans in terms of causing cancer, it was based on the LNT model. So they were assuming that the LNT model of radiation exposure was accurate. And they were saying, even at low doses, the cumulative effect of getting CAT scans or whatever would increase the risk of cancer by this much.
Oh, shit. So they found that at low doses, it doesn't cause cancer, but still above a threshold, it does.
Yeah. So what they found was that the LNT model was based upon flawed data that never really checked the low dose range. They were just extrapolating into the low dose range. And when you challenge the model, you find that there's no evidence to support any risk of cancer at the levels that you're getting with X-rays and CAT scans.
With like modern X-rays and CAT scans.
They didn't make that distinction in the study. I guess we could assume that.
Because, like, we still have to wear, like, lead vests and stuff when we get X-rays.
Yeah, do they?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
Like, I think of old school X-rays. Like, those were pretty cancer-causing. Well,
if you're an X-ray tech and you do 20 a day, I think it's probably still a good idea.
But it might not be necessary.
I'd rather. I'm going to go with the cautionary principle on this one.
Absolutely. Sure, but, in the past, it was a no brainer. Like this evidence saying that your increased chances are unacceptable. But now you could do it many times a day, and you could still be fine.
Well, also, in the past, I don't think that the radiation from an X-ray was well calibrated. I mean, when we think of early days of X-ray technology, you were blasting people with X-rays. And now I think it's a little more calibrated.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, minimal radiation necessary to get the imagery.
Yeah, so the authors, Dr. Welsh and his colleagues, said that the LNT model is an invalid paradigm for estimating risk following low-dose radiation exposure. And they're basically saying that the LNT model is illegitimate and should be abandoned.
So what you're telling me is that the operative word you left out is low doses.
But that's the doses that you're getting in X-rays and CAT scans.
Yeah, I guess that's the whole point. True.
Yeah. I didn't say that there is no risk from them. I said there's no evidence that there is a risk, which is not the same thing as proof that there isn't a risk. Because the previous – he just basically took away the previous argument by saying the model it was based on is not valid.
Yeah.
And there isn't any objective evidence that it actually has increased people's risk for cancer. It was always a theoretical risk based upon the LNT model. And they're saying that this actually is dangerous in that it could be causing people to avoid X-rays and CAT scans that actually they need.
Right.
Oh, interesting. So, like the way that people avoid the body scanner at the airport because they're afraid of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like I had a friend who worked at Whole Foods, and she said that some people wouldn't let her scan their food on the scanner because they were afraid of the radiation.
Yeah. Well, it's Whole Foods, right?
Yep. This is rough.
All right. This means that a newly published computer simulation supports the conclusion that both Jupiter and Saturn significantly protect the inner solar system of comets, making life on Earth possible, is the fiction.
Which is actually good. That's actually good because it just increased the chance of life on planets
that don't have
gas giants.
Well, so this is the Jupiter as shield concept, which has actually been around for a long time.
Yeah.
That Jupiter's gravitational well shields us from some of the outer solar system crap that might eventually come in and impact objects in the solar system like the Earth. I kind of disagree with you guys about the size of the solar system because gravity wells have a long reach, right? Gravity is a long range force. Jupiter's gravity is immense. And also, by the time an object like works its way into
the
Jupiter will have gone around the sun, and you know, plus there's also Saturn out there. Between one of the two of them, they're gonna get in the way. But anyway,
but that assumes an orbit by a comet near the ecliptic.
Yes, that's correct.
Which is
not a bad assumption. In fact, because you know the comets might be getting kicked into the inner solar system by dwarf planets, maybe even the planet that's in the ecliptic. But anyway, what the computer simulation found was that not only is Jupiter not acting as a shield, it's actually drawing comets into the inner solar system.
Jupiter!
Jupiter and Saturn, both of Jupiter and Saturn, they're tugging on these things and flipping them into orbits that bring them into the inner solar system. It's actually increasing the frequency with which the Earth is getting pummeled.
So we survived in spite of Jupiter and Saturn.
Although this is now going beyond their model. They also said that, you know, the Earth occasionally getting whacked was actually good for life, the development, the evolution of life on Earth. But that's, I don't know, that's a separate claim entirely. Mm-hmm. So same conclusion, but opposite reason. You know, it was good for life, but don't, because I guess occasionally getting whacked cleans the slate a little bit and allows for evolution. That's the idea anyway. Then of course, the impact theory is only one cause of mass extinctions. You know, it's not the only cause.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how many of the mass extinctions have been due to impacts?
Right.
True. Like, pretty clearly. Is it like two or three?
Right.
Yeah. I don't know.
I thought that, you know, I've always heard about the Jupiter as shield theory, right? That it was shielding us, but
sure.
And, you know, it was a Comet Shoemaker Levy plowed into Jupiter. Like, there you go, shielding us from comets. It's happening right there. Thank you. But
yes, thank
you, maybe
it's
not. Yes. Again, that was a direct hit. Most are not going to be. They're just going to sort of be tugged by the gravity. And it makes sense. It'll, you know, slinging things into us. It's like throwing things at us from the outer solar system. I've also heard the moon as shield theory, Bob. You've heard that as well, that the moon protects the Earth by drawing things into it that might otherwise hit the Earth, which makes sense. You know, obviously not complete protection, but it might reduce the total number of things that impact. Yeah. It's taking the hit for us every now and then.
Well, with Christmas coming and all.
Okay, I don't get that one. What's that from?
Time Bandits.
Sure.
I'll send you the clip.
Sure. It's,
you've never seen the Time
hilarious.
Bandits?
No.
Kara, I don't know what you're thinking, guys.
No, you don't.
Wait,
know.
That's not.
Put it on your list. Put it on your list.
And the digital watches and the computers. Oh,
it's okay.
Kara, you know, that's not an epic oversight. Don't feel bad. There's other
epic. It's a cute.
What if I told you I've never heard of the Time Bandits?
Okay, that's a little worse.
Why is my left arm hurts?
Show me the way. I'm but a young Padawan.
All right. Oh. Evan, give us the quote of the week.
All right. Quote of the week submitted to us this week by SGU listener Peter Morris from Adelaide. And that is in Australia. Thank you, Peter. Treat beliefs not as sacred possessions to be guarded, but rather as testable hypotheses to be discarded when the evidence mounts against them. And that was written by Philip Tetlock, Canadian-American political science writer and a professor. Wharton School of Art, the School of Arts and Sciences there, and also at the University of Pennsylvania. And his book that he's best known for is a book called Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction, which is where that came from.
Yeah, that's a classic skeptical sentiment. Totally agree. Mm-hmm. All right. Good one, Evan.
Yeah, I liked it. So, and thank you, Peter Morris.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you,
Steve.
Thanks, Doctor.
Thank you, sir.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.